Let's get started. Today we're going to start a new series on the issue of gender and related issues. So today we're going to start with more of a big picture look. And so if today feels like it's a little big picture, that's because it's meant to be. I'll kind of introduce this to the topic starting in Genesis 1. So if there are any questions that you have as we go along, feel free to bring those up if you want me to clarify anything as we go along. But we're going to start with Genesis 1. So you can turn with me there if you have your Bibles. Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. So, not going to read all of Genesis 1, but that starts a pattern that's going to continue throughout the creation week. You'll notice that in the beginning, God creates everything, and that's the beginning of the first day. At that point, the earth is formless and void, without form and void. It's empty, and it's without shape, without distinction. And so throughout the rest of the creation week, God gives the earth its shape. He separates, he divides, he makes things distinct. He also fills it and makes it full. He did not create it to be empty, as Isaiah says. And so he separates light from darkness, and he names each one of them. He separates waters from waters. He separates land from water. He fills the land with vegetation. And the vegetation he separates and creates everything according to its kind. He creates birds and water creatures, each according to its kind. He creates land animals, and finally humanity, and he creates man in his image. So throughout the creation week, we see a pattern where God makes things distinct and separates things and puts things in their place. Everything is made very good. Everything is not just morally good. I mean, things are morally good as God creates it, but imagine light. How is light very good? Is the light, well, I guess it is obeying God by coming into existence, but it's not necessarily like a moral creature. Well, how is the light good? Well, it is good by being fit well for the purposes God has made it for. It's in its proper place. God designs it in wisdom to fulfill its place in the earth. It is fit for its place and for its purpose. There is one goal that all of creation serves. What is the goal of all of the creation? Every part serves this one end. Yes, yeah, it all is to the glory of God, whether it's the heavens, as the psalmist says, that declares the glory of God, whether it is humanity, who is the image of God, and so displays his glory. That is the goal of everything, but everything does so in its own way. Each part does this in its own way, each according to the way God created it, the way God named it. Now, the last separation, or at least one of the last separations, I guess the creation of the Sabbath would be a last separation. But one of the last separations is that of male and female. God makes them distinct. That God creates man and woman, each designed to fulfill its own part in God's creation. Just like all of the rest of creation, he divides them in order that they work in harmony, just as the rest of creation. It's not like God is introducing animosity or enmity by dividing things, but he divides them, makes them distinct, and makes them their own, fit for their own purpose. Thank you. So God makes man and woman so that they might fulfill their own part, well designed for that purpose, and that they might correspond and unite unto fruitfulness and dominion. So this form that God gives the earth is called the creation order. That's what we call it. It is an orderly creation. It is a system. It is a harmony. Things are in harmony when they act according to God's design, which is ingrained in their nature. Just as we create a hammer. Why do we make the hammer the way we make a hammer? Well, it's to hammer nails. It has a purpose behind its design. It's not an arbitrary design. So God gives each part of his creation a design for his purpose. And when they're all acting according to their design, it is harmonious. It is shows God's wisdom. It is very good. Now, Satan, though, sought to undo this order. He is a murderer from the beginning. He seeks to destroy and to kill. He seeks to rebel against God and the good things that God has done, and so seeks to destroy this order. He sought to introduce death and disorder, as I haven't watched the movie, but as I think it's Alfred says to Batman, some men just want to watch the world burn. That is Satan. He wants to see things destroyed and come to disorder and collapse, perhaps out of spite, perhaps out of envy. There's all sorts of devilish motive behind his attack on humanity and thus on the whole creation. The collapse of this order is the undoing of creation, death. Think about how man was created from dust, but what happens when he dies? He returns to dust. This is a curse upon us when we rebel against God and die morally. Think of how the flood is essentially an undoing of creation. Everything gets destroyed because the waters, they come back together, and the waters and the lands, they come back together. All those distinctions that God made in his creation collapse, and that is death, death to that old order which needed to die, but death which comes because of sin, and death which Satan seeks as the one who is a murderer from the beginning. Now, not only Satan does this, but those who follow in the way of Satan, Satan's seed, Satan's offspring, not that Satan created them, but that they follow in the way of Satan, that they have aligned themselves with Satan, as Eve did when she took the forbidden fruit. So paganism has traditionally sought to get rid of some of these distinctions. Paganism has traditionally exalted androgyny, the confusion of genders, the confusion of men and women. Paganism has committed to what Peter Jones has called oneism. Anyone know what that refers to, oneism? So it's the idea that basically everything is basically one kind of thing. He would contrast that with twoism, Christianity, which sees that there's two things fundamentally. There's a creator and there is his creation. And if you don't have that distinction, you don't have someone who's outside of creation who can make distinctions within creation. So if everything's ultimately one kind of thing, you don't really have that ability to make hard and fast distinctions within it. Paganism has often upheld gender distinctions for practical reasons. If you study tribes around the world, and you'll find that often pre-industrial society has sharper gender distinctions on a practical level than we might today, because we're richer and more well off, and we can afford to mess things up a little more than in the past. So paganism often upheld gender distinctions for practical reasons, but in its ritual, in its spirituality, in its religion, and among the rich and among the rulers, it has often sought to transgress those distinctions. And you find that in the accounts of emperors, especially, who wanted to be, as it were, all-sufficient, to embody everything, and so would practice perverse sexual practices and cross-dress and all sorts of things because they sought to be as God and to have all of that in themselves. Rushduni talks about that in his book, The One and the Many. But there's a kind of return to fundamental unity, a kind of union with the divine, a denial of the creator and creature distinction, which takes place. So it's not like gender confusion is a new thing that we have in our day-to-day. It's been something that has been emphasized by pagan religions for a long time. Now, there was one man who came to seminary once when I was in seminary, and he had written a book. It's a great book, two volumes. I haven't read it because it's really long. But he wrote a book on the history of universalism, as a critique of universalism, but recounting the history of Christians, in name at least, who have held to universalism. And his book is called The Devil's Redemption. And when he was talking in time for questions, and I forget the question I asked, but somehow that we got on the topic of how a belief in universalism, which he had described as often comes from the idea that everything was ultimately one and kind of spread apart in all of this diversity, but then everything's going to come back to one. It was kind of a Gnostic idea. And he said that that belief has often preceded and been influential in revolutions. It was popular among philosophers before the French Revolution, popular among, you know, influential people before the Russian Revolution. Ideas have consequences. Ideas matter. And the denial of a doctrine of creation has led to revolt against order and distinctions. Not just gender distinctions, but that's part of it as well. And all of this is strong in our present culture. What has been a big idea in the last, say, 200 years that has attacked the creator-creature distinction? What was that?
Evolution.
That's right, evolution. And evolution has come up with a theory to try to explain this very ancient pagan idea that everything has just come into being. Of course, the Greeks and Romans would say even the gods evolved from the earth or from nothing. But it's a more modern take on it that denies that there is a created order, a designed order, that everything is in flux, is always changing. And so what has passed as objective truth, you know, in the last millennia or two, what has everyone assumed to be, that's the way things are, the way things are designed, those, they would say, are just social constructs. That's just what your society has told you. And in fact, if they're kind of postmodern about it, they'll say that must have been designed in order to maintain the power of the people that were in power, that reduces everything to material causes. So things that were supposed to be objective truth, maybe about men and women, those were just, that's just the patriarchy maintaining their power on society, arbitrary distinctions, because there is no objective truth, because it's all evolutionary change. So what's left to an individual? How do you make a meaningful life out of that? Well, those who would hold to that idea are left with individual choice to be true to oneself. It's not just a cliche. It's kind of actually a philosophy. All you're left with is your own choice and your integrity to your own choice in a sea of evolutionary flux and change. So in this way of thinking, what you're left is to define yourself and to make yourself, to not be subject to such impositions of powerful people. You need to break free from that and do your own thing. Tradition, the created order, authority, whether it's divine or human, all of these are seen as baseless impositions of power and actually dehumanizing assaults on the freedom of the individual. This lends itself to the condition today. Whereas in the past, people might have rejected Christianity because it's not true, is what they would say. They would say, oh, it's not true, maybe textual criticism and things of that sort. Now, on top of that, today people reject Christianity because they would see it as immoral, that you're really imposing something which is wrong. You're imposing something on the autonomy of the individual to define himself and to be free and authentic. And in this revolt against the system, and for radical independence, the area of sexuality has been a major front, a major weapon that has been used to define oneself, to reject the old order. So in this revolt against the created order, one line of attack has been on sexual restraints. So, you know, the Christian ethic of that sex is for marriage. I mean, that has been one front of the battle. But another one has been on masculinity and femininity as prescribed identities that you don't get to choose, that are just given to you. That has been something that has been attacked, and that's kind of going to be the focus of the series that we're starting today. The debate has been, does the individual have the right to choose and create his own gender? Are there only two to choose from? That's even further part of the debate. Or are we responsible to embrace the gender we have been given? Is it something prescribed to us and we ought to live up to? Is it a design purposefully given to us to live according to? Or is it something that we create from scratch, each individual? Otherwise, you're just living accord to a social construct imposed upon you to uphold someone's power in society. So on this issue, God obviously takes a clear position in his word. But before I go any further, any questions or clarifications at this point, or further observations? Yes?
I appreciate that word responsible. I mean, never heard that before in terms of the application.
Yeah, it's not only that we are men and women, but that we ought to then do something because of that fact. That we ought to live according to that design. And we're given that responsibility. Turn with me then to Deuteronomy 22, verse 5. I probably have way too much prepared for today, so I'll probably just stop when we get to time, but we can always pick up next week. Deuteronomy 22, 5. Now, this is part of the case law of the Old Testament, where taking the principles that you might see in the Ten Commandments, applying it to particular cases, and you're supposed to be wise about it and draw principles and see the principles that these cases illustrate. So it might seem like an odd or incidental law here, but it is expressing a very important principle, especially in this issue. So not only, looked at Genesis, but while we were still there, I should have read Genesis 1:27. You know, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So that's a key part of how God made us. Well, let's see what we ought to do about it. Deuteronomy 22:5 says, "A woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a woman put on a woman's cloak. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God." Now, maybe before I comment on it, why do you think that is important, and what does that mean for this issue, that verse? Think about the implications of this case law. What does it say about how we get our gender identity, for example? Do we choose it or not?
Well, I'd say there's a couple of thoughts here. Although not stated, but implied, I think, is that there is some, and it's not stated, so there, you know, we get into the good and necessary consequence. But I think by implication, there is some objective standard of what makes a clothing pertain to a woman and what makes a clothing pertain to a man. Because if there was no objective standard, then it becomes completely subjective, and you have nothing to work with, really, ultimately. But you know, as we think back to God giving Adam and Eve clothing after the fall to cover their shame, right? That's certainly one function of clothing, is for the purpose of modesty. But here we see an additional purpose of clothing, and that is to confirm the maleness or the femaleness in which God made you.
Yeah, those are great observations. Yeah, it's not just to cover, but also kind of to identify yourself and to confirm your identity that God has given you. Yeah, I think there's a number of implications of this, and we'll get into, hopefully if we have time, what makes clothing male or female. But even before we get there, it shows that it's not up to your personal, the way you choose to present yourself. Let me explain it this way. Not only did God make the distinction between men and women and make us as men and women, but it's also an abomination to rebel against this order. This verse would not make sense if your identity as a man and woman depended on your personal choice. For a man to put on a woman's cloak is to identify as a woman, and that's forbidden. It doesn't make him a woman. It's wrong because it doesn't. It is forbidden because what results is not a woman, but a man presenting himself as a woman when a man wears woman's clothes. So gender is determined not by personal choice, how you choose to identify yourself or present yourself. It's prior to that. He's defined as a man before he decides what to wear, how to present himself, how to identify himself. So notice there's both a fact of how God made you. You are a man or a woman. And what that means is somewhat fixed, that God has a design behind that, regardless of how you choose to present yourself. And there's a duty to embrace that identity and to live it out, to live according with that design and to identify yourself that way. So someone who is male by birth also has a duty to act like a man. Yes. Right. What's wrong with the behavior that's being forbidden in Deuteronomy is when you choose to make a different choice than what God has made. Yeah, so we still have a choice, but it's not the one that creates our identity. It's a matter of obedience. So we're going to agree with the identity God has given us.
And if I could, it's not my intent to disagree with you. But the danger in that language is there are people who say, I might have been born male, but I'm presenting myself as female because God made me this way. I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. And that is simply using my own preference to skirt what God has plainly commanded.
Sure. And you have to be like, well, how did God create us? God made us with bodies, that we're not souls that just happen to have bodies. So we kind of get into more of anthropology that way. But it's not up to the way I want to present myself.
Right.
It's a prior identity before that.
Right, and that's my point, but the people will use the term God made me that way to avoid the very identity that God made them that way.
Sure, you know? Sure. Yes.
It's interesting that they use the word an abomination.
Mm-hmm.
Abomination is a strong word, usually used, you know, in instances of like utter rebellion. And I think somebody who thinks they can do that, isn't that, I would consider that utter rebellion against God who created that thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's what sin is.
Yeah. Well, abomination is a stronger condemnation.
Answer someone that answers me the way that the same they do is to say that their God is confused. Their God is presented as creating two different things in one person.
Yeah. And to realize also our thoughts and desires, at least according to the God of the Bible, can be very wrong. It ignores the doctrine of the fall. It just takes the doctrine of creation and skips the fall part. But yeah, if everything that we think and desire comes from God, then you're right. God is very confused because they conflict, they do wrong things. So if we're just calling our desires the way God made us, then God has some really big problems. Yeah, so I would agree with that. I mean, I don't know how much it impacts the image of God precisely more than other sins, but I think it does get at how it it violates it rather clearly the natural order. You know, similar with homosexuality, you know, and other sins that compound the sin in ways like that. But yeah, it is a word that tends to mark out things that are perverse, are especially twisted distortions of God's creation. All right, so yes. Yeah, I mean that's. I agree. I mean that is kind of what sin is. It is irrational in all respects. I mean, someone who lies, that's really obvious, you know. So, but it is a denial of the way God made us. So, yeah, I would agree. All right, so I don't know if I'm going to have enough time to get the next topic, so I guess next week we'll pick up with clothing and symbols that identify us as male or female, how much of that is objective, how much of that depends on one's culture. Just to give a preview, there's the could be objective, could be subjective, but there's also something in between, which is that it is a social construct, and that's good. That language, for example, is arbitrary in one sense and yet very meaningful in another sense. When I say woman, is there anything inherent about the letters W-O-M-A-N that is feminine? In our culture, but that's not objective, but it is meaningful. You don't just get to ignore it. So we'll get into that maybe a little bit more next time. But there's, I think, an element of both. It's not merely social, but it's not. There are social varieties in how that is expressed in different cultures. But just because it's culturally relative doesn't mean you get to ignore it and pretend that words don't have meaning, for example. So we'll pick up with that and go further into this topic and continue to explore God's good creation and how to live according to his beautiful design. So let's I'll turn off the recording and we'll get ready for worship.